the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science!
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey number 58 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Manuscript Found in a Bottle by Edgar Allan Poe. I am your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. I hope you're ready for an exciting adventure at sea today. In selecting which work of Edgar Allan Poe I wanted to run, I wanted to pick one of his stories that wasn't as well known. You know, it would be very easy to do The Telltale Heart, or The Black Cat, or The Cask of Amontillado, or several others like that. But I do want to expose you to some other stories you may not have heard. And so that's what I'm featuring here today. And I'm very grateful that I was able to coerce our narrator today to read this story for me. And reading the stories of Edgar Allan Poe is not an easy feat. There's a lot of strange wordings of sentences, there's a lot of words that aren't commonly used anymore, and it can be a challenge. But I found the man that was up to that challenge, Dave Robison. Now, if you haven't heard of Dave Robison, I guess my first question is, where you been, man? He seems to be everywhere right now, and that's a good thing. When I think of Dave Robison, I think of him as the embodiment of creativity. In fact, if you go to your dictionary right now and look up the word creativity in the dictionary, you'll see Dave's picture there. Trust me. It all started when he was 8 years old, and he was writing Curious George fan fiction on his mother's Smith Corona typewriter. As he grew up, he was involved in theater and in art. And when he went to college, he earned a formal bachelor's degree in theater and an associate's degree in graphic design. And he also said that if you count hours of study and research, he also has an unofficial master's degree in tabletop role-playing games and board games. But in his career, in his creative endeavors, he has created art for magazine covers. He has written and produced radio theater and countless stage productions. In 1993, him and some other people put together the Heartland Players, for which he was artistic director, and they were an innovative community theater company in Illinois. Later on, when podcasting became the thing, Dave was inspired to found a radio theater company, Rabbit Hole Theater Productions, which is a nonprofit endeavor of open stage theater in Fort Collins, Colorado. I mentioned podcasting. I guess the question would be, what is Dave not doing that's involved in podcasting? I don't know where to start, so I'll just start where I first fell in love with Dave here. Up until the end of this month, he has been the host of the Protecting Project Pulp podcast, which is part of Tony Smith's District of Wonders, in association with Starship Sofa and Tales to Terrify. And I really, really love that podcast, and I love the stories that are found there, but it really came alive by listening to Dave and the great passion that he has for pulp fiction and all fiction in general. And he will be sorely missed on that podcast, but I'm sure somebody else will come along and do a great job on there. He's also the co-host and founder of the Roundtable podcast, which is another excellent podcast, especially if you're a writer or you just like creative discussions about writing and creating worlds and things like that. Basically, the format of that podcast is they bring in a featured author to help them in their roundtable, and then they bring in an inexperienced author or any author that is willing to put their work on the table and have it analyzed and added on to and tweaked by Dave and his friends. It's a lot of fun. It's hard to keep up. He's very diligent about getting episodes out every week. And so every week you have an introduction to the featured author, and then you have the roundtable podcast about a specific story. It's been fun to listen to. And that's not going away. He's continuing to do that podcast. But aside from that, his voice has been heard on several fiction podcasts that hopefully you're all well aware of, as I've promoted them here on the podcast before. He's narrated for Escape Pod, Pseudopod. He's been on Podcastle. He's been on the Drabblecast and Starship Sofa and Tales to Terrify. And I just heard him the other day on a Dune Steve episode. And so he's out there. And, of course, now he's been part of the Journey Into podcast, and I'm excited about that. He also recently began narrating audiobooks for Tantor Media, which is kind of a no-brainer. I mean, this guy's voice is incredible. Hugh O'Donnell, the host of the Way of the Buffalo podcast, described Dave's voice as honey and sulfur, which I'm not sure what that means, but I'll go along with that. He's got a very nice, smooth delivery, as you'll find out if I stop talking about him here anytime soon. But there's one more thing I wanted to mention, and that is that Dave's not done. He's in the process of founding the League of Extraordinary Vocalists, which is a collection of vocal performers who will carry out stunt recordings at fantasy and sci-fi conventions for authors who, for whatever reason, would prefer to have a talented voice actor perform readings for their work. And so that's exciting. I'm excited to hear that. And amid all those things that Dave's involved in, he also has a day job. So he's a busy guy. So I'm grateful that he was able to take the time to narrate this story for me for the podcast. And so instead of me blathering on anymore, let's get on to the story. So please, come with me and let's journey into the maelstrom.
Manuscript Found in a Bottle by Edgar Allan Poe. Qui n'a plus qu'un moment à vivre n'a plus rien à dissimuler. Quinault, Attis. Of my country and of my family I have little to say. Ill usage and length of years have driven me from one and estranged me from the other. Hereditary wealth afforded me an education of no common order, and a contemplative turn of mind enabled me to methodize the stores which early study very diligently garnered up. Beyond all things, the study of the German moralists gave me great delight, not from any ill-advised admiration of their eloquent madness, but from the ease with which my habits of rigid thought enabled me to detect their falsities. I've often been reproached with the aridity of my genius. A deficiency of imagination has been imputed to me as a crime, and the Pyrrhonism of my opinions has at all times rendered me notorious. Indeed, the strong relish for physical philosophy has, I fear, tinctured my mind with a very common error of this age. I mean the habit of referring occurrences, even the least susceptible to such reference, to the principles of that science. Upon the whole, no person could be less liable than myself to be led away from the severe precincts of truth by the igne fatui of superstition. I have thought proper to premise thus much, lest the incredible tale I have to tell should be considered rather the raving of a crude imagination than the positive experience of a mind to which the reveries of fancy have been a dead letter and a nullity. After many years spent in foreign travel, I sailed in the year 18 and some years from the port of Batavia in the rich and populous island of Java on a voyage to the archipelago of the Sunda Islands. I went as passenger, having no other inducement than a kind of nervous restlessness which haunted me as a fiend. Our vessel was a beautiful ship of about 400 tons, copper-fastened and built at Bombay of Malabar teak. She was freighted with cotton wool and oil from the Lakshadweep Islands. We had also on board coir, jaggeree, ghee, coconuts, and a few cases of opium. The stowage was clumsily done, and the vessel consequently crank. We got under way with a mere breath of wind, and for many days stood along the eastern coast of Java, without any other incident to beguile the monotony of our course, other than the occasional meeting with some of the small grabs of the archipelago to which we were bound. One evening, leaning over the taffrail, I observed a very singular, isolated cloud in the northwest. It was remarkable, as well for its color as from it being the first we had seen since our departure from Batavia. I watched it attentively until sunset, when it spread all at once to the eastward and westward, girting the horizon with a narrow strip of vapor and looking like a long line of low beach. My notice was soon afterwards attracted by the dusky red appearance of the moon and the peculiar character of the sea. The latter was undergoing a rapid change. The water seemed more than usually transparent. Though I could distinctly see the bottom, yet, heaving the lead, I found the ship in 15 fathoms. The air now became intolerably hot, and was loaded with spiral exhalations similar to those arising from heat iron. As night came on, every breath of wind died away. A more entire calm it is impossible to conceive. The flame of a candle burned upon the poop without the least perceptible motion, and a long hair held between the finger and thumb hung without the possibility of detecting a vibration. However, as the captain said, he could perceive no indication of danger, and as we were drifting in bodily to shore, he ordered the sails to be furled and the anchor let go. No watch was set, and the crew, consisting principally of Malays, stretched themselves deliberately upon deck. I went below, not without a full presentiment of evil. Indeed, every appearance warranted me in apprehending a simoom. I told the captain my fears, but he paid no attention to what I said, and left me without deigning to give a reply. My uneasiness, however, prevented me from sleeping, and about midnight I went upon deck. As I placed my foot upon the upper step of the companion ladder, I was startled by a loud humming noise, like that occasioned by the rapid revolution of a mill wheel, and before I could ascertain its meaning, I found the ship quivering to its center. In the next instant, a wilderness of foam hurled us upon our beam ends, and rushing us fore and aft, swept the entire decks from stem to stern. The extreme fury of the blast proved, in a great measure, the salvation of the ship. Although completely waterlogged, yet as her masts had gone by the board, she rose after a minute heavily from the sea, and staggering a while beneath the immense pressure of the tempest, finally righted. By what miracle I escaped destruction, it is impossible to say. Stunned by the shock of the water, I found myself, upon recovery, jammed in between the sternpost and rudder. With great difficulty I gained my feet, and looking dizzily around, was, at first, struck with the idea of our being among breakers. So terrific, beyond the wildest imagination, was the whirlpool of mountainous and foaming ocean within which we were engulfed. After a while I heard the voice of an old Swede, who had shipped with us at the moment of our leaving port. I hallooed him with all my strength, and presently he came reeling aft. We soon discovered that we were the sole survivors of the accident. All on deck, with the exception of ourselves, had been swept overboard. The captain and mates must have perished as they slept, for the cabins were deluged with water. Without assistance, we could expect to do very little for the security of the ship, and our exertions were at first paralyzed by the momentary expectation of going down. Our cable had, of course, parted like pack thread at the first breath of the hurricane, or we should have been instantaneously overwhelmed. We scudded with frightful velocity before the sea, and the water made clear breaches over us. The framework of our stern was shattered excessively, and in almost every respect we had received considerable injury. But to our extreme joy, we found the pumps unchoked, and that we had made no great shifting of our ballast. The main fury of the blast had already blown over, and we apprehended little danger from the violence of the wind. But we looked forward to its total cessation with dismay, well believing that, in our shattered condition, we should inevitably perish in the tremendous swell which would ensue. But this very just apprehension seemed by no means likely to be soon verified. For 5 entire days and nights, during which our only subsistence was a small quantity of jaggery, procured with great difficulty from the forecastle, the hulk flew at a rate defying computation before rapidly succeeding flaws of wind, which, without equaling the first violence of the simoom, was still more terrific than any tempest I had before encountered. Our course for the first 4 days was, with trifling variations, southeast and by south, and we must have run down the coast of New Holland. On the 5th day, the cold became extreme, although the wind had hauled round a point more to the northward. The sun rose with a sickly yellow luster and clambered a very few degrees above the horizon, emitting no decisive light. There were no clouds apparent, yet the wind was upon the increase and blew with a fitful and unsteady fury. About noon, as nearly as we could guess, our attention was again arrested by the appearance of the sun. It gave out no light, properly so called, but a dull and sullen glow without reflection, as if all its rays were polarized. Just before sinking within the turgid sea, its central fires suddenly went out, as if hurriedly extinguished by some unaccountable power. It was a dim, sliver-like rim, alone, as it rushed down the unfathomable ocean. We waited in vain for the arrival of the 6th day. That day, to me, has not arrived, for the Swede never did arrive. Thenceforward we were enshrouded in patchy darkness, so that we could not have seen an object at 20 paces from the ship. Eternal night continued to envelop us, all unrelieved by the phosphoric sea brilliancy to which we had been accustomed in the tropics. We observed, too, that although the tempest continued to rage with unabated violence, there was no longer to be discovered the usual appearance of surf or foam which had hitherto attended us. All around were horror and thick gloom and a black sweltering desert of ebony. Superstitious terror crept by degrees into the spirit of the old Swede, and my own soul was wrapped up in silent wonder. We neglected all care of the ship as worse than useless, and securing ourselves as well as possible to the stump of the mizzenmast, looked out bitterly into the world of ocean. We had no means of calculating time, nor could we form any guess of our situation. We were, however, well aware of having made farther to the southward than any previous navigators, and felt great amazement at not meeting with the usual impediments of ice. In the meantime, every moment threatened to be our last. Every mountainous billow hurried to overwhelm us. The swell surpassed anything I had imagined possible, and that we were not instantly buried is a miracle. My companion spoke of the lightness of our cargo, and reminded me of the excellent qualities of our ship. But I could not help feeling the utter hopelessness of hope itself, and prepared myself gloomily for the death which I thought nothing could defer beyond an hour, as, with every knot of way the ship made, the swelling of the black stupendous seas became more dismally appalling. At times we gasped for breath at an elevation beyond the albatross, at times became dizzy with the velocity of our descent into some watery hell, where the air grew stagnant and no sound disturbed the slumbers of the kraken. We were at the bottom of one of these abysses when a quick scream from my companion broke fearfully upon the night.
"See! See!"
cried he, shrieking in my ears. Almighty God! See! See! As he spoke, I became aware of a dull, sullen glare of red light, which streamed down the sides of the vast chasm where we lay, and threw a fitful brilliancy upon our deck. Casting my eyes upwards, I beheld a spectacle which froze the current of my blood. At a terrific height, directly above us, and upon the very verge of the precipitous descent, hovered a gigantic ship of perhaps 4,000 tons. Although upreared upon the summit of a wave more than 100 times her own altitude, her apparent size exceeded that of any ship of the line or East Indiamen in existence. Her huge hull was a deep, dingy black, unrelieved by any of the customary carvings of a ship. A single row of brass cannon protruded from her open ports, and dashed from their polished surfaces the fires of innumerable battle lanterns, which swung to and fro about her rigging. But what mainly inspired us with horror and astonishment was that she bore up under a press of sail in the very teeth of that supernatural sea and of that ungovernable hurricane. When we first discovered her, her bows were alone to be seen, as she rose slowly from the din and horrible gulf beyond her. For a moment of intense terror, she paused upon the giddy pinnacle, as if in contemplation of her own sublimity, then trembled and tottered and came down. At this instant, I know not what sudden self-possession came over my spirit. Staggering as far aft as I could, I awaited fearlessly the ruin that was to overwhelm. Our own vessel was at length ceasing from her struggles and sinking with her head to the sea. The shock of the descending mass struck her, consequently, in that portion of her frame which was already under water, and the inevitable result was to hurl me with irresistible violence upon the rigging of the stranger. As I fell, the ship hove in stays and went about, and to the confusion ensuing I attributed my escape from the notice of the crew. With little difficulty I made my way unperceived to the main hatchway, which was partially open, and soon found an opportunity of secreting myself in the hold. Why I did so I can hardly tell. An indefinite sense of awe, which at first sight of the navigators of the ship had taken hold of my mind, was perhaps the principle of my concealment. I was unwilling to trust myself with a race of people who had offered, at the cursory glance I had taken, so many points of vague novelty, doubt, and apprehension. I therefore thought proper to contrive a hiding-place in the hold. This I did by removing a small portion of the shifting boards, in such a manner as to afford me a convenient retreat between the huge timbers of the ship. I had scarcely completed my work when a footstep in the hold forced me to make use of it. A man passed by my place of concealment with a feeble and unsteady gait. I could not see his face, but had an opportunity of observing his general appearance. There was about it an evidence of great age and infirmity. His knees tottered with a load of years, and his entire frame quivered under the burthen. He muttered to himself, in a low, broken tone, some words of language which I could not understand, and groped in a corner among a pile of singular-looking instruments and decayed charts of navigation. His manner was a wild mixture of the peevishness of second childhood and the solemn dignity of a god. He at length went on deck, and I saw him no more. A feeling, for which I have no name, has taken possession of my soul, a sensation which will admit no analysis, to which the lessons of bygone times are inadequate, and for which I fear futurity itself will offer me no key. To a mind constituted like my own, the latter consideration is an evil. I shall never, I know that I shall never, be satisfied with regard to the nature of my conceptions. Yet it is not wonderful that these conceptions are indefinite, since they have their origin in sources so utterly novel. A new sense, a new entity is added to my soul. It is long since I first trod the deck of this terrible ship, and the rays of my destiny are, I think, gathering to a focus. Incomprehensible men, wrapped up in meditations of a kind which I cannot divine, they pass me by unnoticed. Concealment is utter folly on my part, for the people will not see. It was but just now that I passed directly before the eyes of the mate. It was no long while ago that I ventured into the captain's own private cabin, and took thence the materials with which I write and have written. I shall, from time to time, continue this journal. It is true that I may not find an opportunity of transmitting it to the world, but I will not fail to make the endeavor. At the last moment I will enclose the message in a bottle and cast it within the sea. An incident has occurred which has given me new room for meditation. Are such things the operation of ungoverned chance? I had ventured upon deck and thrown myself down, without attracting any notice, among a pile of rattling stuff and old sails in the bottom of the yawl. While musing upon the singularity of my fate, I unwittingly daubed with a tar brush the edges of a neatly folded studding sail which lay near me on a barrel. The studding sail is now bent upon the ship, and the thoughtless touches of the brush are spread out into the word discovery. I have made many observations lately upon the structure of the vessel. Although well armed, she is not, I think, a ship of war. Her rigging, build, and general equipment all negative a supposition of this kind. What she is not, I can easily perceive. What she is, I fear it is impossible to say. I know not how it is, but in scrutinizing her strange model and singular cast of spars, her huge size and overgrown suits of canvas, her severely simple bow and antiquated stern, there will occasionally flash across my mind a sensation of familiar things. And there is always mixed up with such distinction shadows of recollection, an unaccountable memory of old foreign chronicles and ages long ago. I have been looking at the timbers of the ship. She is built of a material to which I am a stranger. There is a peculiar character about the wood which strikes me as rendering it unfit for the purpose to which it has been applied. I mean its extreme porousness, considered independently by the worm-eaten condition which is a consequence of navigation in these seas, and apart from the rottenness attendant upon age. It will appear, perhaps, an observation somewhat over-curious, but this wood would have every characteristic of Spanish oak, if Spanish oak were distended by any unnatural means. In reading the above sentence, a curious apothegm of an old weather-beaten Dutch navigator comes full upon my recollection. "It is as sure," he was wont to say when any doubt was entertained of his veracity, "as sure as there is a sea where the ship itself will grow in bulk like the living body of the seaman." About an hour ago I made bold to thrust myself among a group of the crew. They paid me no manner of attention, and although I stood in the very midst of them all, seemed utterly unconscious of my presence. Like the one I had first seen in the hold, they all bore about them the marks of a hoary old age. Their knees trembled with infirmity, their shoulders were bent double with decrepitude, their shriveled skins rattled in the wind, their voices were low, tremulous, and broken, their eyes glistened with the rheum of years, and their gray hairs streamed terribly in the tempest. Around them, on every part of the deck, lay scattered mathematical instruments of the most quaint and obsolete construction. I mentioned some time ago the bending of a studding sail. From that period, the ship, being thrown dead off the wind, has continued her terrific course due south. With every rag of canvas packed upon her, from her trucks to her lower studding sail booms, and rolling every moment her top gallant yard arms into the most appalling hell of water which it can enter into the mind of a man to imagine. I have just left the deck, where I find it impossible to maintain a footing, although the crew seem to experience little inconvenience. It appears to me a miracle of miracles that our enormous bulk is not swallowed up at once and forever. We are surely doomed to hover continually on the brink of eternity without taking a final plunge into the abyss. From billows 1,000 times more stupendous than any I have ever seen, we glide with the facility of the arrowy seagull, and the colossal waters rear their heads above us like demons of the deep, but like demons confined to simple threats and forbidden to destroy. I am led to attribute these frequent escapes to the only natural cause which can account for such effect. I must suppose the ship to be within the influence of some strong current or impetuous undertow. I have seen the captain face to face and in his own cabin, but, as I expected, he paid me no attention. Although in his appearance there is, to a casual observer, nothing which might bespeak him more or less than man, still a feeling of irrepressible reverence and awe mingled with the sensation of wonder with which I regarded him. In stature he is nearly my own height, that is, about 5 feet 8 inches. He is of a well-knit and compact frame of body, neither robust nor remarkably otherwise. But it is the singularity of the expression which reigns upon his face. It is the intense, the wonderful, the thrilling evidence of old age, so utter, so extreme, which excites within my spirit a sense, a sentiment ineffable. His forehead, although little wrinkled, seems to bear upon it the stamp of a myriad of years. His gray hairs are records of the past, and his grayer eyes are sibyls of the future. The cabin floor was thickly strewn with strange iron-clasped folios and moldering instruments of science and obsolete, long-forgotten charts. His head was bowed down upon his hands, and he pored with a fiery, unquiet eye over a paper which I took to be a commission, and which, at all events, bore the signature of a monarch. He muttered to himself, as did the first seaman whom I saw in the hold, some low, peevish syllables of a foreign tongue, and, although the speaker was close at my elbow, his voice seemed to reach my ears from the distance of a mile. The ship and all in it are imbued with the spirit of eld. The crew glide to and fro like the ghosts of buried centuries. Their eyes have an eager and uneasy meaning, and when their fingers fall athwart my path in the wild glare of the battle lanterns, I feel as I have never felt before. Although I have been all my life a dealer in antiquities and have imbibed the shadows of fallen columns at Baalbek and Tadmor and Persepolis, until my very soul has become a ruin. When I look around me, I feel ashamed of my former apprehensions. If I trembled at the blast which has hitherto attended us, shall I not stand aghast at a warring of wind and ocean to convey any idea of which the words tornado and simoom are trivial and ineffective? All in the immediate vicinity of the ship is the blackness of eternal night and a chaos of foamless water. But about a league on either side of us may be seen indistinctly and at intervals stupendous ramparts of ice, towering away into the desolate sky and looking like the walls of the universe. As I imagined, the ship proves to be in a current. If that appellation can properly be given to a tide which, howling and shrieking by the white ice, thunders on to the southward with a velocity like the headlong dashing of a cataract. To conceive the horror of my sensations is, I presume, utterly impossible. Yet a curiosity to penetrate the mysteries of these awful regions predominates even over my despair, and will reconcile me to the most hideous aspect of death. It is evident that we are hurrying onwards to some exciting knowledge, some never-to-be-imparted secret, whose attainment is destruction. Perhaps this current leads us to the southern pole itself. It must be confessed that a supposition apparently so wild has every probability in its favor. The crew pace the deck with unquiet and tremulous step, but there is upon their countenances an expression more of the eagerness of hope than of the apathy of despair. In the meantime, the wind is still in our poop, and as we carry a crowd of canvas, the ship is at times lifted bodily from out the sea. Oh, horror upon horror! The ice opens suddenly to the right and to the left, and we are whirling dizzily in immense concentric circles round and round the borders of a gigantic amphitheater, the summit of whose walls is lost in the darkness and the distance. But little time will be left to me to ponder upon my destiny. The circles rapidly grow small. We are plunging madly within the grasp of the whirlpool. And amid a roaring and bellowing and thundering of ocean and of tempest, the ship is quivering. Oh, God! And going down.
I don't know if I've ever talked about this on the podcast, but I'm a big fan of the epistolatory format of story writing. And if you don't know what that means, it's when the story is in the format of somebody's letter to somebody else, or somebody's journal writings, or in this case, a manuscript found in a bottle. And you know, I can't help as I picture the ship about to go down into the whirlpool and be sucked down to whatever fate awaits them. And as our narrator hurls the bottle away from the ship, not knowing what its fate or his own will be, you know, I can almost hear his thoughts. Well, anyway, I was very impressed with Dave's reading for this, not just because it was an excellent narration, but also because he pulled off that French phrase at the very beginning. I told him when I asked him to read the story that if he wanted to leave that part out, that it was optional whether he wanted to try to read that or not. But man, he pulled it off. And I thought I'd share with you what that phrase means. So, qui n'a plus, what, well, what was that again, Dave?
Qui n'a plus qu'un moment à vivre, n'a plus rien à dissimuler.
Right, what he said. So what that means in English is, he who has only a moment to live no longer has anything to hide. And so I think that applies to our narrator here. And I also looked into where that quote was from, and it was written by Philippe Quinault, who was a French dramatist and librettist, one who writes a libretto. And a libretto is just basically the text of a dramatic musical work, such as an opera. And Attis was just that. It was a tragic opera that was written in the 1600s. Now, Poe also put a note at the end of this story, and the note reads, "The manuscript found in a bottle was originally published in 1833. And it was not until many years afterwards that I became acquainted with the maps of Mercator, in which the ocean is represented as rushing by four mouths into the northern polar gulf to be absorbed into the bowels of the earth." The pole itself being represented by a black rock towering to a prodigious height. And, you know, many people think that Poe wrote this story as a parody of some of the pseudoscientific theories of the time. One of those theories being the hollow earth theory, you know, suggesting that the earth was hollow and the waters of the ocean, you know, emptied into this hollow earth. One of the early and most famous proponents of this theory was John Cleves Sims Jr., and he had proposed making an expedition to the North Pole. And even the United States President at the time, John Quincy Adams, indicated that he would approve of such an expedition. But he left office before that could happen. And Andrew Jackson, who came in as the next president, kind of put a stop to that attempt of that expedition. But that didn't stop the theory from progressing and for people writing books about it and stuff like that. But it's kind of an interesting theory and kind of an interesting perspective to look at this story at. Everybody has their opinion, I guess. And, you know, Poe's work falls under the literature category. And so it's been analyzed and reanalyzed. And people have come up with what they think are the themes and the reasons for the things that he writes. But, you know, I think that interpretation is definitely up to each reader. And, there isn't one answer for every story. And even with contemporary writers, you know, if Tim Pratt writes a story, he may have several things in his mind as he's writing that story and several plot points or even personal points that he's trying to make in his writing. But that may be read differently by the reader. So that's true with any author and any piece of fiction out there. It is up for interpretation. And I guess when I listen to this story, I get more of a Lovecraftian vibe from this story, that, you know, something supernatural is happening here, and there's evil entities at work. And, you know, I see this ship of undead people that our narrator has crashed upon, and who knows what awaits them at the bottom of this whirlpool. I guess I picture more of a sinister fate for them, like this is going down into the depths of hell kind of thing. Kind of along the lines of the poem, The City in the Sea. So that's always kind of the feeling that I've got from the story. And, you know, Poe has inspired many, many writers. But Poe definitely was an influence on Lovecraft as he was doing his writing. And their styles are different. But as you can see in this story, there are definitely similarities and definitely cues that Lovecraft got from Poe that he used in his fiction. But he did his own thing with it as well. But H.P. Lovecraft has been quoted as saying that Poe is his god of fiction. He was his go-to author. He said that Edgar Allan Poe was his model. And here's a quote that I wanted to read. This is something that H.P. Lovecraft wrote to Fritz Leiber. Next to Blackwood, Poe stands first in basic seriousness and convincingness, though his themes tend to center in limited manifestations of the terrestrially gruesome and in sinister twists of morbid human psychology. In total effect, he probably transcends Blackwood, and indeed all rivals. That is, what he does tell is told with a potent art and demonic force which no one else can even approach. Well, high praise. Jules Verne was also quite a fan of Poe's, and he used a lot of elements from Poe's stories in his own fiction. You have the Poe's story, The Balloon Hoax, which Verne picked up on and he used in his Around the World in 80 Days. And then I guess, come to think of the Hollow Earth theory, you know, you could include the Journey to the Center of the Earth. You know, the reason that Poe is often recognized as the father of science fiction is because he often presents his work of fiction as a believable story by including accurate factual details in there. And that definitely inspired Verne. In fact, Poe's only novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, served as inspiration for Jules Verne to write his sequel to that novel called The Antarctic Mystery. Poe's novel, which I haven't read, but I've read about it. But it ends very abruptly and doesn't give a lot of closure that you would expect from such a long piece of work. And so, and I think Jules Verne tried to take the opportunity to finish off that novel and to also pay homage to Poe by writing a similar type of work. There's many, many authors, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, even current writers like Stephen King. You know, Stephen King says of Poe that he wasn't just a mystery suspense writer. He was the first. And that's a whole other genre that we could get into, but I'm not going to do that today. Maybe we'll get more into that next year when we do Edgar Allan Poe Month. But I've really enjoyed this experience, and hopefully I've been able to showcase some of Poe's work that you haven't heard of before. And hopefully you enjoy it. But stay tuned. We will be back next week, or soon thereunto, with our first place winner in the Edgar Allan Poe contest. And that I might not get that out by the end of the month, so Edgar Allan Poe month might extend a bit into February. But I did get a late start this month with because of the New Media Expo and traveling and things like that. So we can call a month, you know, pretty much whatever we want. We don't have to go by the standard calendar, right? But I do look forward to presenting you next week's story, and it'll be The Mask of the Red Death by Lee Lackey. So tune in next week, folks. And please, let me know what you think of Edgar Allan Poe Month on the forums. You can get to the forums by going to journeyinto.freeforums.org, and I'd love to hear from you there. So until next time, beware of wind in your poop, and journey on. The Journey Into podcast is produced under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, which means that you can't sell it and you can't change it, but feel free to share it as much as you'd like and let people know where you got it from. The theme music for this podcast has been provided by Man in Space.